Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. If you're like me, it's been a while since you had an office job. And again, if you're like me, the office jobs you've had weren't in the most rigidly corporate environments anyhow. They were loose, creatively free-flowing places where people migrate from desk to desk and chat during the day, where lunch can run past the one-hour mark without anybody asking questions, and where the line between socializing and productivity is porous and soft. But that's hardly the norm in America. The people who still have office jobs in this country aren't having a whole lot of fun. They're not being creative. Instead, they're running scared. They skitter from traffic or the subway to a crowded elevator to a too small desk, and they huddle in cubicles like rodents, computer screens inexorably draining the color from their faces as they grind through one more soul-mangling day. And it's been like that since the 70s, though it seems to have gotten worse in the last 10 years or so. The mainstream corporate office environment is pure hell at this point. Bosses pester and spy on their employees as a matter of course, whether by remotely reading their email or just barging into a cubicle with a question or a comment just when it seems like someone might be having a moment of relative mental tranquility. And the age of cell phones, BlackBerries, and iPhones is also an age in which home life, private life, has been crushed out once and for all. If your boss has your cell phone number, you are never off work. But to paraphrase Peter Finch's Howard Beale in the movie Network, I don't have to tell you things are bad. We all know things are bad. Corporate culture is of interest to us here today because of the ways in which it encompasses both sexuality and architecture, combining them in a singularly unpleasant way. Sexuality has been fundamentally altered by technology and architecture in the past, of course. The VCR didn't just kill the porn theaters of the 1970s, it also created a generation of men who lacked the courage to jerk off in a movie theater. And the impact of corporate culture on male sexuality has been every bit as powerful and damaging. First of all, I'd like to stipulate that architecture itself is an inescapably female concept. Professors and critics tell us that buildings are phallic, that skyscrapers are glass and steel cocks raping the sky. But think about it counterintuitively for a second. Who is the dominant sexual partner? The supplicant who receives permission to enter, or the one who physically contains the other within his or her person? To my mind, the person whose flesh literally engulfs the flesh of another human being is the one who's in charge. Within some subcultures, this is called topping from below, but that term implies that there's some sort of unique and circumstance-dependent power exchange going on, and I don't believe that. As far as I'm concerned, it's just the way things are. Buildings are female. So once you accept that core premise, you must recognize that since the dawn of humanity, we as a species have been covering the landscape with all these huts, houses, castles, apartment blocks, and every other type of structure as a retreat from the world and what amounts to an individual and collective symbolic return to the womb. After all, for thousands of years, the world was full of animals that could and would kill and eat us. Only as our technology improved did our surroundings become less immediately and mortally dangerous. Naturally occurring caves were there first, and they're the most womb-like of all possible homes. I think only the fact of our ability to walk upright prevented humans from becoming a burrowing species. Our essential cowardice was overcome by our skeletal structure. And yes, there are plenty of phallic spires and vertically thrusting shafts in the world, but those are at best hollow gestures of resistance against an existential condition we all recognize on some innate level. We all know we're entering our homes to protect ourselves from the horrors that wait outside, and that on our worst days, if we could make the ultimate retreat and crawl back inside our mothers, we would do it without a backward glance. As children, we tuck the blankets over our heads at night, convinced that if our feet don't touch the ground, the monsters can't get us. And as adults, we're still locking our doors and retreating. Even when there's someone in bed with us, we're alone in sleep, alone and vulnerable, and that's why we lock the door. The corporate office environment inculcates the emasculation and containment of being inside a building, but it provides no security, and it adds to the equation the desexualizing power of 21st century office etiquette. Because make no mistake, not only is the modern office a place of near constant surveillance, from keystroke recorders to security cameras that make sure nobody smokes in the stairwell to grim supervisors with prison warden attitudes, it's also a zone in which male-female relations are skewed almost beyond recognition. Now, Now, before we get going here, I just want to make it clear that I'm not calling for a return to the social mores of the past. I have no interest in reviving Mad Men-style predation. I'm simply asserting that present-day zero-tolerance policies regarding sexual harassment, as codified in the 80s and 90s, throw relationships between office workers out of whack in a way that has proven to be psychologically debilitating and even in some cases destructive. I believe it's part of a larger strategy to keep all employees of both sexes in a state of constant low-level fear and thus docile and submissive, but that's a discussion for another time. Some of the ways in which corporate management is a coercive force don't seem related to sex at first glance. In Susan Faludi's book Stiffed, she describes the work environment at one company as being driven by, quote, managerial monitoring. It had 11 layers of management filled with men whose primary tasks seems to be all about surveillance. They spent their days evaluating and correcting employees on the basis of criteria that were rarely disclosed or explained. This aspect of corporate culture has been parodied in numerous movies and TV shows. Think of the scenes in Office Space, where the protagonist is attempting to sneak into and out of work without being spotted by his boss, who inevitably catches him and increases his workload, or where his boss appears suddenly in the middle of the day, trapping him in his cubicle with meaningless paperwork. And there's a similar sequence early in The Matrix, where Neo is scuttling from cubicle to cubicle on his hands and knees, hiding from invading agents about whom he knows nothing. How much more can a character be dehumanized? He's a defenseless, terrified animal, all the more so for being played by the always expressionless Keanu Reeves. These are not sympathetic portrayals. They are scenes that make us laugh, but only out of bitter recognition. The nameless lead character in Fight Club also starts out as an office drone. It's worth noting that his pseudo-revolutionary movement seems populated by men on the lower end of the employment spectrum, waiters, garbage men, other service employees, but he himself is a relatively successful middle-class insurance investigator at the beginning of the film. At one point, his manager finds the Fight Club rules in the office copy machine and confronts the protagonist and audience surrogate, who responds with a thinly veiled threat. I'd be very, very careful who you talk to about that, because the person who wrote that is dangerous, he says. And this button-down Oxford cloth psycho might just snap and then stalk from office to office with an Armalite AR-10 carbine gas-powered semi-automatic weapon, pumping round after round into colleagues and coworkers. Thus, the threat of a workplace massacre becomes at once fodder for comedy and a moment in which we're expected to cheer for the narrator as he threatens his boss. And indeed, in theaters, this bit of dialogue was received with riotous joy by exactly the kind of guys novelists Chuck Palahniuk and director David Fincher were satirizing and celebrating in the book and the movie. To quote Homer Simpson, "Kill my boss? Do I dare live the American dream?" Moving away from the white-collar professionals and blue-collar grunts turned basement brawlers of Fight Club, we find the high-powered corporate executives of J.G. Ballard's Supercan. This novel, released 1 year after the Fight Club movie and 4 years after the book, deals with superficially similar themes, men releasing stress through violence, but from the other side of the mirror. Palahniuk's characters are workers who feel alienated from contemporary life with its bland consumerism and general soullessness, and they attempt to regain their essential maleness by punching each other in the face while shirtless and barefoot. Ballard's characters, by contrast, are relatively comfortable in the world, both financially and spiritually. They're rich men who keep people like Fight Club's anonymous protagonist employed and keep their health insurance funded. These men and women live in a gated community called Eden Olympia and relieve their stress not by battling each other, but by embarking on sprees of crime and violence directed at others. They do this not out of resistance to the world, but out of the urge to demonstrate their total mastery of it and to decompress, that they might re-enter the boardroom the next morning, ready to execute another hostile takeover. The plot of Supercan revolves around Paul Sinclair and his arrival in Eden Olympia as a sort of kept man. He's the semi-retired editor of a magazine with an injured leg, and he only comes there because his younger wife has taken a job there. Soon after settling in, he begins to feel stifled. In his words, "Stability and polity were designed into Eden Olympia. By the end of the afternoon, all this tolerance and good behavior left me feeling deeply bored." Both he and his wife wind up sleeping with other people, but he still manages to be shocked by the mystery of his wife's predecessor, who went on a shooting spree, killing nearly a dozen co-workers with a rifle before dying himself, whether he committed suicide or was murdered by the Ian Olympia security staff. Bernard's primary proxy for his message in Supercan, though, is not Sinclair, but Wilder Penrose, the resident psychiatrist treating the rich, bored residents of Eden Olympia for their insomnia, sexual dysfunctions, and all the other ailments brought on by workaholism. Psychopathy is its own most potent cure and has been throughout history. At times, it grips entire nations in a vast therapeutic spasm. No drug has ever been more potent, says Penrose at one point in conversation with Sinclair. At another moment, he says, a perverse sexual act can liberate the visionary self in even the dullest soul. The consumer society hungers for the deviant and unexpected. What else can drive the bizarre shifts in the entertainment landscape that will keep us buying? Psychopathy is the only engine powerful enough to light our imaginations, to drive the arts, sciences, and industries of the world. Ballard himself echoed this point in an interview with a British newspaper, saying, quote, the main theme of Supercan is that in order to keep us happy and spending more as consumers, capitalism is going to have to tap rather more darker strains in our characters, which is, of course, what's been happening for a while. If you look at the way in which the more violent contact sports are marketed, American football, wrestling, boxing, and, of course, the most violent entertainment culture of all, the Hollywood film, all these have tapped into the darker side of human nature in order to keep the juices of appetites flowing. On the surface, this seems like exactly the opposite of the message Fight Club is sending, until you remember that Chuck Palahniuk wants you to buy his book, and David Fincher wanted you to buy a ticket, and then maybe later the deluxe DVD box set. As the late stand-up comedian Bill Hicks said, he's going after that anti-marketing dollar. That's a big market. For decades, Ballard was the go-to guy for upper-class laments about the alienating horrors of Western culture. In a way, he was the mirror image of Philip K. Dick, whose best novels examined paranoia and loss of identity, but from a grubby, lower-class perspective. But both men were extremely funny while simultaneously exploiting satire's freedom to be unfunny. As Michael O'Donoghue famously said, making people laugh is the lowest form of comedy. And both Dick and Ballard understood this completely. Books like Crash and Concrete Island and Dick's A Scanner Darkly satirize 20th century society, but do so through a prism of horror. This is probably why David Cronenberg, a one-time horror filmmaker who got above his station, was fascinated by Ballard, but it's also why his adaptation of Crash was such a failure. For those who don't know, Crash, the book and the movie, are about people who can only achieve sexual arousal and satisfaction through the medium of car crashes, from talking about accidents they've been in as a form of foreplay, all the way to actually having sex in wrecked cars and penetrating each other's wounds. Cronenberg's film version is too restrained by half. By this point in his career, he'd become too cerebral a director to bring this material to the pulsating life of earlier, squishier works like Videodrome and The Brood. And the demands of mainstream cinematic ratings boards limited his ability to present a story that, according to Ballard, was intended, quote, to rub the human face in its own vomit and force it to look in the mirror. Perhaps worst of all, it wasn't even beautiful. Crash would have been a much better film if it had been a high-end porn movie directed by someone like Michael Mann. Now there's a guy who could have splattered a chrome bumper with gleaming drops of cum and made the audience believe in the character's compulsions while doing it, even if, or maybe because, they'd have been played by toned, waxed porn stars instead of James Spader and Holly Hunter. What's fascinating about Supercan, though, is its distance from the reality of workplace shootings as we in America know them. That distance is understandable given that A, Ballard lived outside the U.S. in a country where guns were difficult, if not impossible, to obtain. But what he's doing by making the shooter a rich doctor treating richer patients is allowing upper-class characters to adopt a fundamentally working-class and middle-class behavior. They're slumming. And as always in such cases, it it comes off condescending and even a little offensive. The Lard's characters are sheltered by their wealth from any true hardship. They take drugs and they sleep around out of boredom. They're dressed in uniform jackets like some sort of perversion of a high school clique, and they attack prostitutes and immigrants, not out of frustration at an oppressive society, but as a way to stimulate themselves to greater heights of financial predation. They have more in common with the antagonist, General Zaroff, from the short story The Most Dangerous Game, or with one of the Marquis de Sade's jaded, cruel aristocrats than with real-world criminals, who are mostly driven by desperation and the nihilism bred of poverty. In the real world, in America, workplace shooters are much more likely to come from working-class or, at best, middle-class backgrounds. The continued erosion of the middle class breeds them to some degree, but in my view, so does the psychosexual environment of the contemporary office. With no outlets for sexual energy and or stress relief available to workers, with surreptitious porn viewing a trackable and punishable offense, and given American society's continued conflation of sex and violence as more or less equal forms of entertainment, it's no great leap to view workplace shootings as sexual acts in themselves, the ultimate rejection of corporate attempts to repress the libido. An early paradigmatic example is that of Richard Farley, an employee of Electromagnetic Systems Labs in Sunnyvale, California. He stalked a female coworker, Laura Black, for 4 years, beginning in 1984. After he'd been leaving notes and gifts on her desk, sending her multiple letters each week, snooping through her desk when she wasn't around, and visiting her home, Black was able to get the company's HR department to intervene, and Farley was terminated in May 1986. On February 2nd, 1988, Black obtained a restraining order against him, which was to be made permanent on February 17th of that year. On February 16th, Farley, by then unemployed and living in a motorhome, showed up at ESL with two shotguns, a rifle, four pistols, and a knife, along with over 1,000 rounds of ammunition. He killed seven employees and wounded four, including Black, before surrendering to police. He's currently on death row in California. Patrick Sherrill was the inspiration for the phrase going postal. A relief carrier in Oklahoma, he killed 14 employees and himself in a rampage on August 20th, 1986. The day before, he had advised a female employee who'd spoken kindly to him in the past that she should stay home from work the next day. He ultimately killed seven men and seven women before shooting himself. America has workplace shooting sprees because corporate America creates the atmosphere that breeds these type of situations, but it's also because America has the guns. Shooting a gun, particularly a long rifle or shotgun, is one of the most blatantly phallic slash sexual acts a man can perform. Its symbolism is obvious to even the dimmest observer. And it's something gun manufacturers and the propagandists of gun culture emphasize in their rhetoric. Gun magazines fetishize indefinable terms like stopping power and refer to pistols in 32 caliber or smaller as women's guns. Sentences like "street results of the stopping power of this 9mm weight velocity combination have been very good for a very long time" are meant to conjure up images of urban gunfighting in the minds of fantasy-prone readers. A review of a 10mm pistol from the website of Handguns Magazine reads like something out of Penthouse Forum. It starts with, "My 1911 45s have served me well, but I've always longed for a bit more power. I had been contemplating building a 10mm for some time when Nighthawk's Craig Golson called and asked if I wanted to take a look at its new Heine 10mm long slide. How could I refuse? The hole in the target just got fatter and fatter as the Nighthawk hammered one 10mm slug after another into a big, ragged hole." I mean, this was literally the first website I went to, and this is like the second review I found. So the combination of the unmistakably phallic and sexual act of shooting with the previously described room-like nature of buildings, and particularly offices, is irresistible metaphoric territory for any novelist or screenwriter with the proper mental alignment. The rabbit warrens of cubicles are like the interior of a uterus through which the bullets slash ejaculation of the frustrated and finally explosive man fly and lodge. And we also have to pile on an additional metaphoric layer or two, because now we have to discuss the imagery of the gape and the facial cum shot. The gape, for those who aren't familiar with it, is when a woman is anally penetrated in such a forceful and repetitive way that her anus becomes distended and hangs open as the camera and lights illuminate the ruby red flesh of her colon. It looks remarkably similar to a toothless mouth or a gunshot wound. The term cum shot, meanwhile, derives not from sex, but from pornography. It's a cameraman's or director's term referring to the capturing on film or video or hard disk of a man's penis ejaculating semen onto the face or body of his sexual partner. But modern Americans have so thoroughly absorbed the values of pornography that even men who are not shooting amateur porn and posting it on the internet likely now think of their own orgasms as cum shots, as though imagining someone filming them as they ejaculate, perhaps even as an aid in arousal. The idea of being a porn star is much more exciting than the idea of just being there all alone with whoever you're having sex with. Part of the appeal of the cum shot, of course, is its ultimately particularly masculine character. It's something a man can do to a woman but which she cannot reciprocate. Indeed, porn industry pros have discussed this issue. "We're the last bastion of masculinity," says porn veteran Bill Margold in Susan Faludi's Stiffed. "The one thing a woman cannot do is ejaculate in the face of her partner. We have that power." But in fact, this is not true. And in the years since Faludi's book was published, a niche market for squirting videos depicting female ejaculation has grown. These include videos in which men masturbate women until they ejaculate, and others that feature all-girl scenes wherein one girl squirts on another girl's face. So the facial cum shot now crosses gender lines. And that leads us inexorably to the emergence of the female workplace shooter. On February 12 of this year, Dr. Amy Bishop, a biology professor at the University of Alabama at Huntsville, shot six of her colleagues at a department meeting. Three died and three were wounded. She was arrested and is currently incarcerated, awaiting trial and potentially the death penalty. She had been denied tenure and was completing her final semester of employment at the university, and had previously shot her brother in 1986, a case that was ruled an accident until the 2010 incident. And she was questioned in 1993 regarding a letter bomb while she was employed at Children's Hospital of Boston. As you can tell from her history, Bishop does not follow the traditional pattern of the male workplace shooter. While she had been fired, she was not just erupting in resistance to a momentary injustice, but rather capping off a lifetime of insanity, during which other outbursts had been directed at relatives and co-workers in other jobs. Still, we must ask what it may have meant for her. What satisfaction did the attack give Amy Bishop, and what will future attacks give the women we can safely predict will carry them out? Thousands of American women carry guns now, and their economic positions are no more secure than those of their male counterparts. If we view shootings by women as metaphorical sexual acting out, as I am advising we do in the case of men, does this mean women's sex drives are becoming aggressive and predatory in the same way as men's? I suspect this to be true. There's a large subset of women who are as sexually predatory as men are often described as being. Not only the cougars of contemporary pop culture mythology, older women who pursue younger men for purely sexual purposes, but also younger women involved in what's being called hookup culture. Porn star Belladonna has a video series called Fucking Girls, in which she has rough lesbian sex with a variety of women, adopting the violent hair-pulling, face-slapping, and ass-gaping of gonzo male-female porn to an all-girl context. And mainstream Hollywood has already given us many examples of sexually aggressive women, decades worth, really. They're usually found in the roles of overbearing, emasculating bosses. In 2008's Wanted, James McAvoy's character Wesley is humiliated and verbally abused by his manager prior to becoming a super assassin. Only once he's become rich and powerful can he stand up to her as a crucial part of the movie's overall power fantasy structure. On the other hand, Michael Douglas's character in the 1994 movie Disclosure never makes that leap. He's utterly at the mercy of female characters throughout. Demi Moore's character attempts to seduce and destroy him, and he's saved enslaved by a female attorney and a female coworker. The male characters are pawns throughout the movie. This came only a year after Douglas had portrayed an unemployed office drone who snaps and goes on a citywide gun-wielding rampage in 1993's Falling Down. And since Hollywood is extremely conservative in its sexual attitudes, the aggressive woman is still seen as the villain, as she has been since the days of film noir. What's different, what's modern, is the passivity of the men. This very real timidity has been bred into men and reinforced through movies like the ones I describe over a period of decades. Think about the phrase hostile work environment. That's how too much flirting, overenthusiastic sexual interaction is described in employee manuals. In this formulation, human sexuality is redefined as a form of hostility. Now, again, there are limits, but every sane man already knows what they are without a lecture from the HR department, and offices too frequently have zero tolerance policies and attitudes that in no way acknowledge gray areas, or the fact that many relationships have been built on foundations that might, in retrospect, look extremely suspect. How many of us haven't pursued someone sexually attractive in ways that could easily have been perceived as over the top by a third party, especially one whose job it is to spot and punish such behavior? I can testify, though, to an extremely different corporate culture. From 2000 to 2005, I was one of the editors of the porn magazine High Society. The company for which I worked also published several other porn titles, including Celebrity Skin and Playgirl, the only two magazines in the entire office that had female staff members. Without sounding overly jingoistic, America makes the best porn in the world. In Richard Rayner's book, Los Angeles Without a Map, his narrator muses that all the pretty people moved to Hollywood starting in the 1920s, hoping to get into the business, and they started marrying and breeding with each other, and they ultimately wound up creating a master race in California. Plastic surgery has provided the next evolutionary step, building on nature, and now our porn stars are the most paradigmatically porn star looking in the world. It may surprise some of you to know that there was no sexual harassment going on in the office of a porn company. Instead, there was friendly banter and a generally relaxed atmosphere. On the creative side, porn is a remarkably low-stress business. On the business side, it's really tough because everybody's losing money. But, you know, when you're looking at naked pictures all day, how agitated can you really get? Indeed, looking at porn on a work computer is explicitly forbidden to most cubicle drones, but it was the basis of our day. Much of what we saw wasn't even private. When photo sets would arrive from photographers, the magazine's various art directors would bring them to a light table in the center of the office and go through the slides there, trading sets back and forth if they seemed to suit the needs of one magazine more than another. Of course, not everything was for publication. High Society's art director had a hard drive stuffed with images and video clips of astonishing vileness. Bestiality, scat, and sudden and horrifying violence that had nothing to do with sex made up the bulk of the material, which we would all gather around his monitor and watch in horrified fascination. The link between clips of extreme sexuality and clips of extreme violence, or photos of people with deforming diseases, is hard to explain, but it's all part of the same impulse, and the appeal is undeniable. In the movie 8mm, Joaquin Phoenix's character says to Nicolas Cage's character, "There are some things that you see and you can't unsee them." My coworkers and I, and this included my boss, really enjoyed seeing things that couldn't be unseen, challenging ourselves and each other to keep watching. But somehow the experience of watching these videos and seeing these pictures in a group drains away the horror and turns it all into black comedy. Any minor stress that might build up during the day can be excised in 5 minutes through gasps of shocked laughter. Unfortunately, if similar behavior goes on in other offices, it has to be much more surreptitious, and ironically, this piles an extra layer of stress onto workers' shoulders, especially in times of economic insecurity. And that's a big problem today. Companies treat their workers like slaves and criminals rolled into one, spying on them and never letting them forget that they can be fired at any time. Everyone knows someone who's out of a job. Most people know someone who's been out of a job for a year or more. So the appeal of porn and violent entertainment grows exponentially. The pressure builds, and if and when the hammer comes down and someone's tossed onto the street, the guns come out. The biggest problem, of course, is that ultimately none of this matters in the real world. How does it help us to embrace workplace shootings as metaphors for sexual acting out, a response to the emasculating effects of office culture? Are corporate managers likely to suddenly welcome unfettered sexual dialogue between coworkers? They are not. Cubicles and managerial monitoring of internet traffic have taken away a worker's ability to lock his or her office door and release the day's tensions. If workers had spaces of true privacy, they would be happier and ultimately more productive, and maybe nobody would get shot. But it seems like this is just one more way in which Americans are going to have to accept a few bodies as the cost of doing business.
Okay, first question. Number one, fucking brilliant.
So, number two.
Number two, I just wanted to offer this one kind of comment. And early on, you talk about not a penetration, but of the reverse. And you didn't seem to have much of a word for that. And I recently came across a word called valprehend, valprehend, V-A-L-P-R-E-H-E-N-D. And it comes from strong, the word val and prehend, like comprehend, comprehension, understand. So valprehend is essentially a neologism for actively engulfing, especially in sexual context, which I have kind of taken a liking to and I wanted to share.
Yeah, no, that's cool.
So I guess that's really important for me. If there's one thing that's important.
I'm just curious if you've read or what you think of Mark Ames' book Going Postal. I have not read it. I know of it, but I haven't read it. What's the deal?
I haven't read it either.
News of it. It sounds really interesting.
And yeah. I was curious if you could tell me whether I should buy it or not.
Yeah, no, I haven't.
So you mentioned that you're expecting to see a lot more women murdering their colleagues, which is exciting. I also followed the Bishop case with interest. But I wonder if you might think more about the fact that typically when women have murdered people historically, it's been families in the domestic sphere. And since women have traditionally until, within the last like 5 or 6 decades been doing all of their labor in the domestic sphere, maybe you're sort of misunderstanding the ways in which women have been going postal historically. Maybe we've been doing it all along, but we've just been killing our husbands and children because that's our labor, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Yes, it's good.
Well, I think that there's probably eventually going to be a conjunction just because I read some survey where people said that, upwards of 75% of people now are meeting the people that they're in relationships with through work. So, eventually those two spaces are going to coincide, and that's when, the emergence of female workplace shooters will really blossom, I think.
I didn't mean to suddenly be laughing really hard into the microphone. Annalyn's comment was awesome, and I loved your talk. Talked about the idea that American Express porn, and that there's a kind of genetic argument for why Hollywood would have the most paradigmatically porny porn stars. It was fabulous, and it reminded me though of some studies that have been done about Silicon Valley and the increased incidence of Asperger's syndrome and autistic children, which seems to bear out some sense that if you collect a bunch of computer programmers in one area and they breed with each other, that you're going to see increased incidence of maybe some of their edge characteristics.
So I think what we need is sort of a breeding program where we get porn stars to sleep with computer geeks, and then you'll get really smart people.
Obviously, you're a man ahead of your time.
That's why I'm
going to
comment this year.
Can you have the microphone this
minute? Yeah.
Sure, there are no questions.
I'm sure. It would be a shame.
It is.
I have to ask a personal question. Good that you put your head on. What was the most engrossing picture that I've seen in your job? You were like the feeling of laughter about, like, when you were looking at the bestiality images and all this stuff. Was there something, what's the thing that you still have not unseen?
There are a couple. I've seen a decapitation. I've also seen a clip of a really obese woman who just kind of bends over like a sawhorse, and then a male horse just charges in and penetrates this woman, like slamming her into the sawhorse. It was really, and it was being filmed by her husband, you know, and it was really, really, because you can hear this sort of domestic dialogue, you know, before it starts. She goes, okay, honey, bend over, you know, and she bends over the thing and then just, boom, you know, it's like she's hit by a truck, but she seems 100% into it. So, you know.
The thing that's fascinating is that you just described a thing that you can't unsee, and now that you've described it in words, I can't unsee it.
I'm telling you, it's
beautiful. Okay, my second question or remark would be, we've heard a wonderful talk yesterday by Jason Brown, where he was talking, among other things, that is mitochondria, about 4chan. And we are pretty much like already the super organism, and 4chan is a good metaphor for what we are going through. I mean, there is a whole generation, all the beatards out there, who are like confronted with that shock images all the time. I mean, that's their, it's their leisure time. It's what they're doing all the time, and pretty much like circling through the most extreme images that are possible. And I would be interested in, maybe you have an opinion about what is 4chan doing to society, as, not from a conservative perspective, but from like an interesting the liberties of not being able to really understand what's going on.
Well, this gets back to the comment that I made earlier about self-selecting communities, and I feel like 4chan is very, very self-selecting and very resistant to outsiders. So I'm not sure what the effect is on the larger society, except to the degree that some of these people have regular jobs and interact with other people, you know, on the street, and I'm wondering whether at some point it will impair their ability to function socially, you know.
Because I've heard people who cannot speak beyond memes. I've heard discussions of people who have like, they have like bar conversations between geeks, and if you do not know 4chan, and if you do not know your share of meme dime, it is impossible to understand what's going on.
That is
just like, it's like seven layers of
whatever. I remember reading, I think it was in The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe. He talks about how test pilots can tell you everything you need to know about a plane using only numbers. You know, and someone standing right next to them will have no idea what they're talking about, but two guys that know all these numbers and what they signify can talk for hours. So I think the 4chan and the internet meme thing is, in its own way, just a type of technical jargon that serves to inform and exclude at the same time. And I think the exclusionary value of jargon is often forgotten. I think that people think about it as people who know things telling each other stuff that they each need to know. But there's a real power to being able to communicate in a secret language, you know, in the equivalent,
jargon can get to the point sometimes where it's almost like, you know, the secret language that twins have, you know, where no one else can understand them.
And an interesting thing about fortune is it's like the secret language of like child pornography or stuff.
Yeah.
It's like twin bestiality.
Yeah,
like, yeah. It's very secret.
I guess I kind of have the same question, but less on lines of like 4chan and that level of extreme violence, and more just sort of the increasingly extreme violent sexual images that we get in pop culture, you know, like with something like Saw, or just, you know, contemporary horror movies that are just very, very visceral. And do you think that that is some kind of like extension of this drive that we're deprived of more and more at work, something that's being hidden from us?
To a degree, I think horror movies are really paradoxical, especially movies like, especially the Saw movies, because they satisfy the need and the lust for extreme violence, but morally speaking, they're extremely puritanical, much more so than even the Friday the 13th movies were, which, as everybody knows, if you have sex in a horror movie, you're going to be killed by the maniac. And the Saw movies are much more, they're even worse than that. They're effectively, you know, the character is effectively putting people through show trials for moral offenses. And it's a weird combination of the extreme violence that people come in looking for, but they come out indoctrinated with this weird sort of value system, you know, and he's trying to, I think the first one, he literally came out and they had like the big speech at the end where he explains that he's trying to get people to value their lives by torturing them. You know, it's self-actualization through pain and gadgetry. So...
Interestingly, one of the most bizarre and interesting horror films of the last 2 years is pretty non-explicit. And it's, I'm not sure if you heard about the film, it's called The Human Centipede.
I've heard of it, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, The Human Centipede, which is pretty much like a horror film about like Aston Martin surgery. and the interesting concept is like, it just like blows up in your mind and say, and then the basic idea is that this like crazy German, of course, surgeon, like takes three people and pretty much like makes surgery like and mounts like the head of one person to the ass of the other person, and so they would have like one gastric system, and that's pretty wild. But you never ever, because they didn't have a lot of money, so there's not a lot of splatter in there. You just like see like it's like three poor like actors and actresses like on the ground and move with. But still, it's a very interesting thing, and it was hard for me to unthink the idea of like Aston Martin surgery.
The first time I heard about The Human Centipede, I didn't even think about ass to mouth or anything like that. I just thought of the old joke about sled dogs, where unless you're the lead dog, the view never changes.
What I'd like to add concerning the Aston Martin thing and your statement about morality is the interesting fact that the guy created The Human Centipede because he made a joke among friends. They were discussing how child molesters should be prosecuted. And he said, an interesting way would be to pretty much like stitch the child molester to the ass of a fat truck driver. And that's the way, like, he thought it up as like a punishment for someone who did something bad, like child molestation. Just like sew them like to the ass of a fat guy, which is an interesting like starting point of the whole film, which is not about morality, but it starts with this like moralic impact.
Sorry, I'm just going to add to your Human Centipede thing. It actually is much more like Saw. It is a moral judgment. I mean, he does judge them, and the reason why those characters are sewn together is because they've all been bad people, and they're really douchey, and like...
The Japanese guy, who's
the head guy, talks at the end about how he's lived his life like an insect, and that's why he's doomed to die like an insect. And two women are like these horrible I don't know. Anyway, I don't know why I'm talking about this on speaker.
There was an interesting bit on the TV show Louis a few weeks ago where the guy was talking, where Louis C.K. was talking about if we would loosen up our societal taboos against child molestation, it would cut down on child murder. Because he says, you know, once you've had sex with someone's child, you pretty much have to kill it. And he said, if we could make child molestation less morally reprehensible, then we could just sort of have sex with the kids and then give them back rather than having to kill them.
I'm not sure how to follow that.
I guess it was this idea of the sort of puritanical punishment of horror movies, and it immediately made me think of Dante and the whole idea of you did this and these are the terrors that are going to be visited upon you afterwards, and that actually recurs in other cultures. In Cambodia, there's this weird sculpture park of Buddhist hell where if you lied to someone, you're going to have a hot poker stuck down your throat, and if you were fat, then your ghost will have a very small mouth. So I guess it's a long run, Adam.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any more? Yeah. Big applause for Philip Freeman.